This is today. It's about 4 to 5 in the evening of April the 17th, Thursday, 1975, and we're at 425 Grant in Palo Alto, apartment 29, and I'm in the living room of apartment 29 with Admiral Arnold E. He is an Echo True, TRUE, retired United States Navy. And Admiral True was the Fleet Air Base meteorology at Pearl Harbor in the mid-1930s. And I'm here to interview him for the purpose of background for the Line Islands, for the meteorology in early days in Trans-Pacific flying, as he may remember them, preparations and forecasts for the Amelia Earhart flight, and also any memories you may have of meteorological or other things during the search, and also particularly his cruise down to the Line Islands on the Shoshone in 1937. And that was in March of 1937. I'm start the tape room where Mr. Admiral Crewe and I are sitting in his living room here, and we just let that thing run. You'll forget all about it inside of a couple. You were telling me that, well, you were just remembering back.
Now, the men went down, and they were a maintenance crew as well as weather observers, and they sent out a standard set of weather observations of sky and pilot balloon soundings for upper winds and things of that sort, which were very useful in forecasting weather anywhere, and the same reports that are made all over the world at the present time. And they maintained the airfield there. Then I went down the Shoshone, and our first stop was Howland Island, as well as I can remember. We may have stopped briefly at Johnson. I can't be sure of that. But anyway, we got to Howland, and we radioed ahead to the boys on the beach that we would like some lobsters for dinner when we got in, and they supplied us with a good batch of freshly caught lobsters around the coral reefs of Howland. And it's very strange that Howland has got very steep from the coral down to the deep water. No decent anchorage at all. And so the ship had to just lie to off the island all the time while we were there. When we got ashore after our lobster, and I went, I think, one of the first groups, and found big tables filled with fish drying in the sun. They were perfectly delicious. I'd never eaten raw dried fish before, but I liked them very much. And then, of course, we expected, I can't remember now how long, whether it was 1 or 2 days before Amelia was due to arrive at Howland. But anyway, we were sending out weather reports.
By the way, is this your... I didn't mean to interfere. And this isn't official.
No,
just
this is my wife. This is Mr. Long.
Hi, Mr. Long. Very glad to meet you, Mr. Would you
have some?
Oh boy, would I ever. Thank you.
The cream and sugar.
Black like my heart.
And me too, thank you. And there wasn't really very much activity on our part, except we got word that she took off from New Guinea, and we sent weather reports, and the conditions, as I recall, I can't remember details, but as I recall, they were about normal for the equatorial region there.
This is when you were down there in March.
I was down at Howland.
I see.
On board the Shoshone. And I could have done this just as well from Pearl Harbor, for that matter. But I was pleased to get an opportunity to go on board the Shoshone. And for tropical weather, there is frequently what we call a tropical front, or discontinuity between the atmosphere of the two hemispheres. And the winter hemisphere sort of underruns the air from the southern hemisphere, and it creates what we would call up here a cold front type setup. That is, it produces big heavy thunderstorms, and these are scattered along this front. And it's due to the interaction of the air from the two hemispheres. Now, this is quite normal, but it's usually a very narrow thing, and it was actually encountered by our flyers from Pearl Harbor later on when they went down to search for Amelia. And on one occasion, one of our good flyers turned back because he couldn't get through this front. But ordinarily, it shouldn't be too difficult, and ordinarily you can get around the thunderstorm. He just happened to hit a particularly bad case, which I thought was worse than anything that she should have encountered en route. And so we knew of no weather phenomena that should have interfered with her flight at all, unless she just dived right into one of these big tropical storms.
Well, now, I'd like to elaborate on something, and I hate to digress. However, I have an expert on Pacific Basin meteorology at my disposal, and isn't every day I get that. And the thing I want to put down is it correct, and I am under the impression that it is, and is it correct that in general, the zone of convergence, or the tropical front, or equatorial front, or whatever you want to call it, tends to move north and south with the sun, but lagging by about 2 months. In other words, lagging by about 8 or 10 degrees.
Very true, and follows what we sometimes call the heat equator, because after all, geographical equator has nothing to do with the incoming radiation. Since the sun moves north and south, that's the heat equator follows, and it does lag by about 2 months.
Then, in the case of March, when the sun is just crossing the equator northbound, the heat equator, zone of convergence, the equatorial front, would probably tend to be a little south of the equator.
That's right. It should be a little south of the equator.
And then, speaking again, mainly of the Pacific Basin, though I guess it's pretty well true in the Indian Ocean, Atlantic as well. But then, in July or June 22nd, when the sun is at its most northerly point, if it's lagging by about 2 months, the equatorial front would probably be 500 or 600 or 8 or 10 degrees north of the equator at about that time.
That's true, although the movement is not as quite as great out in the western Pacific as it is in the eastern Pacific.
Now, when you say western Pacific, are you speaking west of the international dateline, or?
I'm thinking of west of here.
I see.
And the west part of the Pacific Ocean.
Would you say anything west of Honolulu is western Pacific?
I see. Right.
So, we're not considering the international dateline as being mid-Pacific, then you would consider that western Pacific?
Well, yes, I consider anything beyond the middle of the Pacific as being a western Pacific.
Okay. And
anything this side being eastern Pacific.
Well, then, in general...
And that tropic front, before we leave, that tropic front also moves back and forth on short intervals, too. Because sometimes you get an outbreak of cold air from the winter hemisphere that'll push it the other way, and then occasionally you'll get a movement of warm air that will throw it back. So it will have diurnal, daily, and weekly movements as well as the annual.
But the band of normal movement tends to shift the band up following the sun by a couple months. Okay.
Yes, and the weather isn't always bad along it. Sometimes I've gone through the equatorial front and nothing but a flat, calm, milky sea and maybe a few cumulus clouds floating around with beautiful weather. But at other times, I've seen very heavy thunderstorms. One time, just off Panama, we were going down one of the battleships and our cruisers, and we sent off a couple of observation planes to go and land Panama. And there were some extremely heavy thunderstorms, and these two people, planes, apparently entered one of them, and just got rained into the ocean.
Mm. And they were both lost.
Both lost.
On July 3rd, the PBY you were speaking of, that was out of Blue Derby, Pearl Harbor, heading down to Howland, evidently hit a rather severe series of
equatorial
front about 600 or 700 miles north of short of Howland, had to turn around and come back to Pearl, which kind of puts the front in its wanderings north of the equator, at least as far as the particular longitude of Howland Island was concerned, while it may snake around. But in general, that would, I'm getting way ahead of the story. You'll find us, as we go along, I'm fairly knowledgeable about everything that was going on around today, but I won't. That isn't the purpose of my visit, to show you how much I know. The purpose, find out what you know. Getting back to the Shoshone, were you interested in the observations that the ship was taking, the meteorological observations that they were taking at all?
Oh,
you know, the Coast Guard ship, just to see how they did things?
No, naturally, I took a look at the observations. They seemed to be done in a normal manner.
Mm-hmm. Was the Navy and Coast Guard standardized at that time in their logs?
I couldn't say, really. I think we got our instructions for the observations from the U.S. Weather Bureau.
Did you have any thoughts in your mind in those early days about a report from a ship being a military ship was more valuable than if you had conflicting reports? You would.
Yes. We usually evaluated depending on what kind of personnel we thought were aboard. And if they had been trained aerographers, mates, that is, Navy people trained in weather reporting, we gave a great deal of confidence to it. And to some of the merchant vessels, we were a little bit dubious about.
How about some of the Matson liners, for instance?
Well,
they just another merchant vessel, as far as you were concerned, or did you have?
Well, as I remember, they were pretty good. And seems to me that a few of the Matson passenger liners carried a Weather Bureau man on board.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that.
I don't think they all did, but I seem to remember a weather reporter from the U.S. Weather Bureau. Correct?
But you felt a disciplined ship, a Coast Guard or a cutter or a Navy ship, their reports were probably more reliable than the average merchant vessel.
Well, I think in general, yes.
Okay, no controversy over this point. I'm just curious to how your mind was working at the time. The logs of the ship and the Coast Guard, the standard logs that were used in the mid-30s, had a hourly weather report. And it was quite extensive. I don't know if you remember seeing those kind of logs, but they were pretty standard.
Yeah, I think I remember.
Started out with the hour, and you had to not only get all the
wind
visibility and whatnot, but also the direction of the swell, the movement of the clouds, and what type of clouds, and whatnot. What I'm getting at is the official logs of the Shoshone and the official logs of the Itasca would probably reflect a fairly reliable what the weather was really like at the given hour stated. Then I mean, you would think that this would be highly, especially if the weather conditions followed a pattern. In other words, if 1 hour we don't have a 92 degree temperature, and next hour a 74 degree temperature. But as long as everything seems to fit,
I should think that they would be reasonably good.
I wasn't around the Navy and Coast Guard in those days. I didn't join the Navy until 42, and I just I know that we were very conscientious when I went into the Navy on all official logs and everything. But went in there, if you were, we had so many minutes with them to take our observation. And you didn't take it on time, or you didn't dare put it down as having been taken. Whatever the limits were.
Well, on this cruise, I considered it sort of a holiday in a way, after a fashion, a lark, and I don't recall that I tried to observe all, I mean, to check all the performance of the people right in the weather log, but I recall looking at them, and I can't remember any discrepancies that looked screwy.
How about the weather observations from the Line Islands, from Jarvis and Baker and Howe?
I can't for the life of me remember just what we got from them, except for the fact that there was nothing that, that looked hazardous. That I think that they just, as near as I could possibly remember, that they just reported through cumulus clouds and general gentle easterly winds and stuff of that sort.
Do you remember how accurate their upper air observations were? Especially
no.
Holland and Baker were only 60 miles, or, you know, 35 miles apart, nautical, mm-hmm. and 40 miles apart. They had a good chance, you had a good chance to check on each other. Of course, winds in those areas are usually so reliable that you could almost fake it. Nobody ever know the difference. But, you don't remember how accurate...
I don't remember definitely what they were reporting as upper winds, although I think I would remember it if there'd been anything unusual or anything that would strike you as being dangerous or out of the ordinary.
Well, how were you able to forecast for the fleet and for the Clipper fleets and whatnot, especially and also for the case of Amelia Earhart on her flight from Ley later on in July, the winds. Where did you get enough information to?
You had to go on pretty slim pickings there, and about the best you could do was to take climatological reports and hope that like the Farmer's Almanac does, you know, and then compare them with the very scattered few that you could get off ships and others. Most of the ships didn't take upper air at all. And
do you remember?
Seems to me that there was one, I guess it was Navy tugboat that was on her route between Lye and Howell, that did have an aerographer's mate on board and was taking upper air sounding. And,
that would be the Ontario.
Yeah, the Ontario. And, I can't remember what we got in the way of upper air from Jarvis and those other islands.
They took observations every day at noon, upper air observations. We were supposed to take them at midnight, but they forgot to take batteries for the lanterns, and they couldn't. So that was out. They'd run out of lights for the balloons. Do you remember if you got any from anywheres in? Did you get any observations from New Guinea at all, or maybe from?
Sure, I can't remember.
How about Nauru or Ocean Island, or possibly Henry Gilbert's Tarawa?
Can't recall that either. don't think we got anything from any of the Japanese invaded islands.
Do you remember? I have all the reports. I don't have them all with me. I have one or two with me that I wanted to show you. But we're getting way ahead of myself here. I'm getting way ahead of you, and I shouldn't be. You went down on the Shoshone, and do you remember, I can't remember just offhand who the captain of the Shoshone was. I have it here.
I can't call his name either.
Also on board was a Coast Guard commander by the name of Frank Kenner. Do you remember Frank Kenner?
Not very well.
You remember he was there at Honolulu for quite a long time, and his wife's name was Betty.
Probably one of the young watch officers on the Shoshone was I think son or nephew of the commandant of the Coast Guard.
Uh-huh. Therein lies a story.
You've already heard that again.
Go ahead, tell it again.
Well, maybe I shouldn't tell a story unless they're already out. This wasn't reported at the time. But the Shoshone did run aground on a reef there. No particular damage, but it flew off.
You know, actually, you must remember, there was no radar in those days. And, like you say, it was very, very steep. The sides of Holland and Baker Island both are very steep. And even a depth sounder, if you were on a set of a half a knot or so, unless you check the thing every 5 minutes, wouldn't give you any warning that you were approaching the reef. It's pitch black on those islands, and until they finally got smart, and I think it was after, see, they learned from experience. Then they took ashore, and they put a lantern on each end of the island so a guy could get some idea of his range.
Yeah, we, Tony, we had the light, too, and one night we drifted clear out of sight of the island. The next day we had a heck of a time finding the damn thing. It's only about so far above sea level. I think the skipper must have misjudged the direction that we had drifted, so he went clear by it without our being able to see it. And we did quite a lot of searching there before we finally located it.
Probably had to wait till afternoon to get a noon fix before you could find the thing. There was no radar in those days. There was no direction finding capabilities. There was no Loran. There was no way that a man could navigate except what he could see. And it was pitch black night, and there was no thing. The set was supposed to be to the west, but it wasn't that for some reason or other. The set got to be to the east for some reason or other, and ended up running on the reef there. Well, it wasn't underway, just, were you on board at the time?
Yeah, I was on board at the time. And as I recall, there wasn't even any crash, or I didn't even know the thing was aground until somebody told me later on, or during the night, I was asleep.
Did you have private quarters on the Shoshone?
A small stateroom.
You had a small stateroom? So.
And I don't think there's anybody else in mind.
Do you remember where the wardroom was, the officer's wardroom was?
Pretty vague about that. There was a wardroom, and I may have shared my cabin with somebody else, but I can't remember now who it was. Oh, yeah, I think I do. It was a newspaper man. Tall, skinny newspaper man.
Was he from the Honolulu Advertiser?
May have been. I'm not sure what paper it was from.
They feed you pretty well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the two Bishop Museum men that were along with us were in search of some of these coconut crabs. because you're about nearly extinct. And later on Palomino, we caught several of them. And one of them was sufficiently large to feed the whole wardroom mess.
Oh? Now, see, that was March of 1937. I have, this is Panala Al Memoirs by E.H. Ed and Brian. And I'm looking for your particular cruise. I'll show you this book. In fact, I'll make sure you get a copy of it eventually here, because it's there's a picture of you in it too, by the way. Let me see. March 37. Okay. That was Coast Guard cutter Shoshone. Your cruise number 9. You left Honolulu on 10th of March 37 under Commander Finlay. And Mr. Black was the expedition leader, the emperor. I don't know if you got in on that or not, but Emperor Black returns in the flag. Please,
would you like some more?
Oh, only if you were going to pour a little more. I didn't. Don't need to.
No more for me, thank you.
And Ham Meyer was. Was with you also.
Yeah, I remember Ham Meyer. What was his capacity?
He was head of the army units. And actually, Harold or Ham Meyer, they called him, he was a captain at that time. He, in the army, was, he eventually took over from, well, Kenner took over really from Black as head of the colonists, and then Meyer took over, and then Meyer was head of them right up until practically starting the war, and he milked that duty for quite a few years, and of course he went on the first expedition when they laid him out. But what I was looking for was, see, that was on Shoshone, Finley, Black, Meyer, and you got back, here's your routing. Let's see, you went to Howland first, you were right, then to Baker Island, and then to Jarvis. And you didn't stop anywhere else. At least this may not be correct. This is not the official log of the ship.
Well, we had Christmas Island on that tour.
It's possible.
I know I've been to Christmas Island, and if I didn't go on that tour, I can't remember
when
I did go.
Well, I would have to look up the official logs of the ship. But anyway, I'll show you a picture of yourself here, and you'll have fun with this book. Because it has all about the colonies, and Ed and Brian put it together, and it's a quite an interesting book about the colonization. But it's not a book to be picked up and read. It's a book to for research and whatnot. Let's see.
I have a copy of it.
You say you do have?
I say I would like.
Oh yes, I'll make sure you get a copy of it. I'm looking for your picture, because that's a piece of resistance. It's a picture of three gentlemen. Yourself, Captain Meyer, and Daniel Cooper. Daniel Cooper was a lieutenant in the Army. You know, maybe that picture isn't in here. This is Bob Campbell, Black, and this is Harold Meyer, taken these days. And this is, I think that, what is that? Kenner. Yeah, that's Kenner there. Ooh, you go ahead and look at the book. I didn't mean that. Yeah, I was looking for. I'm pretty sure the picture's in there. If not, I have a picture of you. Do you have any pictures from those days at all? If you'd like to have some, I have all sorts of pictures of that I've collected over the years.
No, I don't recall any that I had at that time.
Did you go ashore on Howland at all?
Oh yes, yes, I went ashore.
Did you? Watch the fellows take any of their upper air observations at all? Do you remember at all?
Yes, I think so. Casually, I can't recall distinctly. thing that stood out in my memory was the dried fish on the table there.
Well, I'll tell you, that dried fish belonged to Yao Fai Lung. And Yao Fai was a radio operator there at the time. And he put together a couple, 300 pounds of dried fish while I was there. He didn't have anything else to do, and he brought it home. Listen.